Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
This guy sort of shoves these paper bags through the window at you, and you walk away with, a box of chocolates and some toilet roll.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson. Now, Ian, this week is away at the Consumer Electronics Show. We're going to unwrap that weirdly bearded, hairy presence later and see what he gifts us from that side of the pond. But in his place this week, to talk a bit about CES and also about the broader landscape of UK technology, is Mr. Andrew Hoyle.
Hello there.
Now, you've been here 2 weeks in a row. This is becoming a habit.
It is becoming. It's a wonderful habit, though. One that I'm happy to have, unlike all my other vices.
Indeed. Well, Andy's here from CNET.com, of course, where he's senior editor. So primed and nicely placed to help us talk about consumer electronics this week, and we'll come to that in a bit. We're going to start by noting something that happened with Tesla this week. Before the end of the year, we'd actually heard that Elon Musk's car maker was going to increase the price of its vehicles in the UK as a result of the weak pound that followed the Brexit vote. Now, Tesla has delayed that price hike by a whole 2 weeks to the 15th of January. It's a 5% price increase, which doesn't sound like a lot, but on a Model S, which is about $60,000 in Britain, that's a £3,000 rise for the vehicle. Tesla said that exceptionally high demand was one of the reasons for the grace period. Not entirely sure how that makes a difference over a fortnight, but that's the official word. But it is obviously just one more example of promised higher prices from tech companies since the vote. Others including Dell, HTC, HP, Asus, Microsoft, even camera lens maker Sigma, amongst others, have all mentioned that they're going to be raising prices. But at least Tesla's delaying it by 2 weeks. The question, of course, here is that, is a 5% more expensive Tesla Model S still worth buying? Andy has driven one across the continent, so I thought it'd be worth asking him. Andy, what's your view?
I love the car, and I think it is still worth that money. But bear in mind that $60,000, that's the starting price for the car, and once you add on any kind of extras, as with all cars, these cars come with seemingly infinite amounts of add-ons you can get, which I think the one I drove was just under the £100,000 mark. So if you add on that same percentage, then suddenly that extra money is seeming like quite a big step. The thing to keep in mind with the Teslas as well is that not only is it a price rise on the car itself, but Tesla, later this year, is stopping the free charging for everyone. At the moment, when you buy your Model S, you can drive it wherever there's no more cost, because obviously there's no fuel. And when you pull up to one of the Tesla charging stations, you recharge your car for full, for free. And that isn't going to be the case anymore.
But is that something that's separate to this 5% hike? I'm assuming that's just coincidental.
It is coincidental, because this is globally, it's stopping this. So this isn't a case of it's just the fluctuating pound that's caused this, but this is rather sort of Tesla's business model that I think it's just that they're finding it a little unsustainable, and particularly with their next car, which is coming out, called the Model 3, which is designed to be much more affordable. That's going to be starting around a $30,000 mark. It's obviously a lot less than the Model S. They're basically sort of trying to find out ways to make a bit more money, and the charging points is kind of one of the areas it's looking at sort of monetizing a little bit more than it currently is doing. But that's worth keeping in mind, because if you're buying a car in the UK, not only do you have this price rise, but you will need to keep in mind that you will then also be charging to you will be charged to charge your car. We don't know exactly how much Tesla's going to charge for use of the superchargers on the go. Hopefully it won't be that much. It may just be a cursory amount to sort of help the infrastructure keep ticking over. But until we know more, it's difficult to really say yay or nay on that.
Well, I'm glad we asked the question then in that case, because to me, 5% price increase for a £60,000 car seemed quite significant. But it actually sounds like it's probably not the end of the world.
No, I think possibly not. And particularly if you are paying 60, 70, 80 grand for a car, that small amount extra isn't probably going to be much of a big deal. These are luxury cars, and it isn't the price that's tempting you to them. It is the luxury all-electric aspect of the car. So I don't particularly think that price is going to be a big factor.
Well, let's talk about things that are big factors for a lot of people. Health. One of the interesting stories that I noticed this week is that the UK's National Health Service, the NHS, is going to start a six-month experiment with an artificial intelligence healthcare app called Babylon as an alternative to the current telephone consultation service. Right now, if you're worried about a rogue lump or a cough or a rash or something oozing from somewhere that typically does not ooze, you can call 111 and a trained medical professional will give you some advice and what your next step should be. But with this app, a trial of which starts this month for about 1 million people in North London, worried users can type in a symptom into the app rather than speaking it over the phone to a professional. There's an AI system behind the app which will ask follow-up questions, and based on a supposedly vast knowledge of the world's diseases and lumps and oozes, and it will know the warning signs, it can then give you some course of action and the kind of urgency you need to apply to that action. So it's expected, apparently, to take about 90 seconds of consultation time through a back-and-forth series of about 10 to 12 questions. And currently, at least according to a write-up I saw in the FT, it takes about 10 to 12 minutes for a human call handler to dispense the same advice. So it's something that's going to speed up that consultation period, but obviously using machines and artificial intelligence rather than speaking to a friendly voice on the phone. So one of the questions I had at this point is whether this is the kind of thing that we'd actually want to do. And weirdly, over the last sort of 12, 18 months, I think I've called this service once. Fortunately, no problem. I know Andy doesn't mind me mentioning he called it once, also was fine. So I thought we could talk a little bit about whether we would actually have wanted to call that same service. Rather than call the same service, we want to use the app. Andy, what's your first take on this?
My initial take is one of slight worry, because I see this being very much akin to just Googling your symptoms and going on a service like WebMD, which, and I'm sure I won't be the only person who's ever done this, and it is very common that whatever you put in pretty much seems to come back with something life-threatening and horrific. You put in symptoms of headache and dizziness, and then the result is, of course, cancer. And that, for a lot of people, could cause a lot of anxiety, a lot of people suddenly rushing off to the hospital in a sweat because they think they're about to keel over. And whereas when you're talking to somebody on the phone, they can take a lot more things into account. They can ask you a lot more follow-up questions. They could ask you, were you drinking last night? And you can say, yes, 11 pints. And said, well, that may be the cause of your headache then in that case, which may not come across in the app. And I think on the surface, yes, this I see the idea that it will reduce the impact on people going to their doctors needlessly, but I think this could really cause a lot of worry in people who otherwise just don't need to worry.
I think at the moment, because this is a trial, this is exactly the kind of feedback that they're trying to gauge. You know, they want to have a decent sample size of people to do this. It's interesting that they chose North London. Maybe there are more hypochondriacs up there. Maybe more calls originate from north of the river than south of the river in London. But it's that's exactly the kind of feedback that they're obviously looking to get. I mean, personally, when I first read this, my thought was, this reminds me of what happened with self-checkouts, is that this is a way of having an alternative alongside the existing model of paying for stuff, but in a way that lets, you know, a majority of people be seen by a computer. It's run-of-the-mill, it's fairly routine, it's generally got the same outcome, and then humans step in when there's a problem. And that's something that is going to happen with this app if it determines that actually, yes, maybe you do need to speak to somebody, maybe you need a consultant to have a word with you, then that will invoke a real physical human, and you'll have a conversation with them. This is kind of the first step there. But that also made me think, you know, keeping the self-checkout thing as an example, the frustration that people do often go through with self-checkouts and the annoyance about bagging areas or not scanning certain objects and having to call someone in quickly, that makes me think it's only going to be magnified tenfold if you're in a state of very heightened worry because of a symptom you've got. But yeah. Then I guess it's all about choice. And if that was your situation, you'd probably still call 111 as opposed to using this app.
Well, possibly, as long as those services are still there. But it could also be like the same frustration you have if you call a regular helpline and it's, please dial 1 for this. And you just hammer 0, bypassing all the menus until they eventually put an operator onto the phone for you. Like, the same thing can just happen there. It's just causing steps in between. But I don't know. I'd be very skeptical of this working better than just Googling the symptoms, because presumably it's using essentially the same sort of algorithm. You know, do you feel X? Okay, then you've got Y. And, you know, there's probably a few other questions in there. But I try very hard whenever I feel anything to never Google it.
I mean, this isn't a new service. Babylon has been around for a while. It's not even the only one. I mean, Babylon, just as one example, you know, its normal product is for one-off consultations via video call or via a phone call. And you pay, I think, £20 for one consultation, or you can pay £20 a month, like a subscription fee for some of these systems. Another one's called Push Doctor that does the same sort of thing. There's another one called Doctor Now. There's a lot of these apps, and they're generally about putting you in front of a doctor when you're unable to get in front of a doctor. This question answering system is more of a step before that rather than a replacement for the consultation itself. So my overall belief is that this probably will be a thing we'll see more of, because people do seem to be liking using them in general. And this is more the NHS's way of seeing if this could save them a few £100,000 a year on those initial consultations with humans, in which case I think not a bad reason to have a 6-month trial.
No, I think that's it's a good idea in theory. The problem is as well that so many symptoms, there's no yes or no answer. And I certainly, when I've called the NHS Direct phone line service, and they've asked me things like, is my headache debilitating? I'm like, well, it depends on there's a lot of things that's very much down to how you're experiencing it. And it's, I find it very, very difficult, and I have to ask them to almost clarify their question in a way so to make sure that I am giving the right answers. I'm not saying, yes, this is a terrible thing, I can barely move, I can't see, but I'm giving the right answers so that they know what's wrong with me. And I think that's even more difficult to do when you're just answering questions in a form, in an app.
If you are in North London and you exist between January and the summer this year, which hopefully you will do, you can let us know what this is like. If you are able to test it, or if you're able to and willing to, even anonymously, that would be really interesting to hear some feedback for podcast@natelangson.com. We'd love to hear that. Obviously, being health, if you do let us know, please let us know how much of it you're willing for us to discuss. podcast@natelangson.com. Well, it wasn't a brilliant start to the Consumer Electronics Show of 2017 this year when Gary Shapiro, the president and CEO of the group that runs it, said the UK government's lack of support for startups attending the show is a, quote, source of embarrassment.
Ooh, burn.
Indeed, you're going to need a big plaster, better call Babylon. It reminded me of last year's CES, when we learned France was in either, I think, the number 2 or number 3 spot behind the US in terms of the number of startups present at the show, partly, if not mostly, because of governmental support. A BBC report this week agreed with my memory and stated that there are nearly 5 times as many French companies attending this year's CES as British ones. And Shapiro said, quote, Britain's been a little slow to the game, honestly. We have a minister from Britain coming, but there's not a lot of activity that we've seen at CES. I think it's a source of embarrassment. He partly blamed short-sightedness of ministers because the show is in seedy, gambling-loving Las Vegas rather than somewhere more conservative. Our government obviously hit back. Digital and culture Minister Matt Hancock said he didn't think that's the case, and we have a whole series of companies at CES when speaking to the BBC. He said government support was there, although I have to be honest, I watched his interview with BBC's Rory Kellan-Jones and was kind of underwhelmed and uninspired by his rather defensive comments. And obviously, Shapiro at the Consumer Electronics Association is is playing the part quite strongly, because obviously the more people who come to CES, the better it is for them. But it's not hard to see that France and Israel and China and others are clearly doing everything they can to be represented at the UK, while we seem to be at least taking something of a back seat, which is a bit of a shame. But there's a couple of really good videos on the BBC about this view, if you're interested. But I thought that was a good segue into having a little bit of conversation about what we saw at the show, specifically what Ian saw at the show. He wrapped himself up in some bubble wrap, the big bubbles, not the small ones, you know, those really big satisfying ones that takes like 2 or 3 fingers to pop. He wrapped himself in those and he hopped inside a very large box, FedExed himself to the show. I didn't go, so he presumably had a bit of a struggle to get out of the box at the other end, but he did manage it, and he did get very excited about the BMW 5 Series prototype self-driving car, which he took a tour in himself to see what all the fuss was about. And he sent in a report about these cars and self-driving cars in general and what he's learned about them at the show this year. Ian.
So one of the other things I've noticed at this show this year has been the fact that with the autonomous cars comes the need to occupy the people who are in the cars and no longer needed for driving. So I sat in a BMW demo, we drove around Vegas, which was an interesting experience in itself, and they showed us all the sort of things that they're planning on doing while you're in car. You'll be able to get information about local landmarks, that's all done through gesture control, so you sort of point in the direction of the thing you want to sort of hear about, and then the car is able to sort of read you through dictation various pieces of information, which is quite cool. They've also there's a lot of cars here that have Cortana built in. There's also been a massive boom in sort of Alexa being included in cars, which I guess is kind of an interesting thing, because it means you're going to be able to get cars which you'll be able to use to control your home as well as the in-car systems. Very interesting, but it's quite funny to see that basically we have to fill up our time in our cars, and if we're not driving, we have to find something else to do. But one of the more amusing demonstrations was something which was a sort of proof of concept, if you will, about Amazon Prime Now delivery. What you do is you're driving along, obviously the car's doing the driving, so you're browsing the internet looking at things to buy on Amazon. Then what you're able to do is get a Now delivery, and the car will program in a place to meet the delivery driver. You follow the instructions in the car, and you pick up your Prime Now box. And BMW gave us a little demonstration of that, and it was relatively entertaining. This guy sort of shoves these paper bags through the window at you, and you walk away with a box of chocolates and some toilet roll or something. But it's an interesting idea. I don't think they're rushing to get that out, but it's one of the many pieces of car technology that I've seen at this show.
More from Ian later, but very exciting, I think, that, Andy. Quite an interesting idea to cars basically being the cinemas of the future in some sense.
Well, obviously, when people aren't going to be actually driving the cars, people are going to need something to do other than just sit there twiddling their thumbs, particularly to keep them awake so that they can be around to take care of any problems that might happen. But on the other hand, I think you've got to play the balance where you don't want somebody being that distracted by, say, a movie or a game or just plain sightseeing, like Ian said, that if the self-driving part of the car decided to crash into a lorry, you can't be there to take over.
I mean, this is something that you may have experienced slightly, didn't you, in the Tesla when you were testing that? Like, it drove itself for certain parts of your journey.
Yeah, the Model S that I drove, it had cruise control that would automatically adjust speed depending on how close you were to the car in front, and it would steer itself within the lines on the road. It scans the lines and keeps you going. So for about half an hour on the road, I didn't touch the pedals or the steering wheel once. I just sat back and the car did the whole thing, which was great, but I wasn't messing about, I wasn't doing anything, I wasn't on my phone. I was making sure to pay full attention to the road, because this is new technology and I wanted to make sure that if anything did go wrong, which sometimes it did, it didn't detect some of the lines, it tried to maybe move me over a little bit, or particularly when I was trying to turn off the motorway, it would start bleeping and try and almost wrench the steering wheel back in line, because it sensed that I was going over the line, which obviously I was trying to do because I was leaving the motorway. So I think it's important to not overdo the self-driving stuff, in the sense that you'd get bored, basically.
One of the things I find interesting about self-driving cars and what we've heard from CES this year just comes around the need to have driving skills at all. I was asked by someone I was talking to the other day whether their children, who are currently approaching car driving age, are ever actually going to need to learn how to drive. And my answer, which I should point out, I don't drive, so I'm kind of separate to all this anyway, is that it'll probably in much in the future, maybe in 10, 12 years' time, possibly be more like the emergency stop. You'll have to learn why you need it, you'll have to learn how to do it, and you'll be tested on your ability to do it. But whether you'll ever actually need to do it, as in physically learn, physically take the wheel and drive a car, is a completely different question. And I think that that, at least in the medium term, is possibly where we're going. And so these sorts of ideas that Ian's talking about entertainment and about having the car do a whole bunch of other useful tasks for you, but still have a driving, you know, a steering wheel and pedals in front of you, is possibly the way we're still going to see things for some time.
I still think we're a very long way off that. I think self-driving and autonomous cars, they are great for urban transport and for big cities, particularly like London. Getting individual private cars off the road is great, and replacing it with cars that can follow their own routes and do stuff like that themselves is a great idea. But the problem is that the infrastructure that these cars need means that you can only really do that in cities. And the idea of having a self-driving car that's going to get itself all the way out to the country and all over these picturesque routes, like that's much further away. And this is quite separating from the pleasure of driving and just getting into a car and putting your foot down and enjoying the drive and enjoying doing that. And I think there's still people don't want to lose that.
Ian seemed very excited about the idea of a car being able to drive him to the meeting point to pick up chocolate and toilet paper. I mean, what a future.
He just wants a taxi, though.
This is
like, he doesn't need a car. He just needs a taxi,
yeah,
who can take him to the shop so that he can buy things for his kids.
Yeah. Well, the toilet roll or the chocolate could easily be for him. Probably
that's
both. Now, we'll come back to Ian a little later when we talk about televisions and some other things from CES. We're trying to split the CES stuff up into two parts. Highly likely, if you're listening to a weekly tech podcast like this, you've probably heard most of what's exciting at CES anyway. But there was one other thing I wanted to mention at this point that amused me massively. It really gave me a big beam on my face. It was probably about, I can't quite tell here, maybe about 4 or 5 inch smile. It's pretty big. Was Griffin, which is both the name of my grandma's deceased schnauzer, but also a maker of electronics equipment, and they have made a smart toaster. And it got ridiculed a little bit on the internet for being just a step too far in terms of Internet of Things and home automation. But I was sitting looking at this toaster, and it had some buttons on the front that looked like eyes, and I felt it looking back at me. And I thought, I like this. This is a very cool idea. Here's several reasons why. One, I like toast done in a very different way to Scotch pancakes or crumpets. I like my toast lighter done. I like my crumpets very well done. And I like my Scotch pancakes somewhere in the middle. This is different for different people in the household. Andy, who visits here on a fairly often, fairly regular basis. For those who didn't know,
I'm here right now, Nate.
He is here right now. Andrew is of course, my brother. My fiancée, Kate, also likes things like Pop-Tarts done, but she always does them very, very, very light indeed. So one toaster just has so many things to remember that having an app or a little display that lets you precisely tap, okay, it's Nate, Scotch pancakes, does it in a certain way. It's Kate, Pop-Tarts. It's Andy, toast, or anyone else who visits here. That, to me, just actually felt like a really, really good idea. And we're talking about it because in Britain, we eat a lot of toast. I've been to America, never been that impressed with the toast. The meat, fantastic, but never so much toast. And I did wonder if that was why the US press was less excited about this than maybe we are. Andy, you are a consumer of bread. What were your thoughts on this specific product?
I'm on your side about this. This is exactly what we need. I live in a flat share with just some people, and every time I put in bread or a Scotch pancake, it's always seemingly on the wrong setting. They turn it down to one, and then it pops up immediately, barely toasted, and then I've got to fiddle with the settings, and all the numbers have worn off, so you don't really know what you're getting. And there are some buttons that's, I think one's for defrosting a bagel, and why does that need to be there? And so this seems like the solution to both our problems, although maybe no one else has the same tastes in Scotch pancakes and toast that we do, Nate. I think that's the issue. This is our product, and no one else is really that first.
That's what I love about a niche. When you see it and you think it's designed for you, it's just a great feeling. Warms the soul. I wanted to pick that one out as an item that maybe didn't get as positive praise elsewhere because I wanted to start this year off with a positive, you know, a positive bang. So let us know what you think to this and whether you would be as excited about a customized app-controlled toaster as Andy and I are. podcast@nateslangson.com.
Nate, while we're talking about stupid connected items...
I never said stupid. That was your word. I thought it was brilliant.
Okay, well, other people's opinions on stupid. I do want to do a quick mention to... I don't even want to name it properly because I think this is ridiculous, but there's a £200 smart hairbrush from Sears. This is the first smart hairbrush that apparently uses pressure sensors and motion sensors and even microphones to tell you the condition of your hair and whether you're brushing too hard, which is... I think this is too far.
It's got microphones in it.
Yeah.
Should have been called a hairbrush. We'll come back to CES later and another report from Ian, but in the meantime, let's talk about something that's very exciting a bit closer to home. BBC Earth has announced a new partnership with Facebook's virtual reality headset company Oculus to launch three new VR experiences. These will be available for the Oculus Rift headset and the Samsung Gear VR in the coming weeks, according to a story on Engadget. Essentially, if you wear a headset and you load up one of these programs, you'll be able to interact with these three episodes that showcase the habits of the... Andy, you may have to help me out with the pronunciation of these things here. What are these? The Carousel Cat?
Caracal Cat.
Oogpeast?
Oogpeaster Beetle.
Okay, and some black bears. I can pronounce that one. That's no problem. Well, let's pick the cats one as an example. The BBC said it will freeze Pussycat mid-air, or mid-jump rather, to let viewers zoom in and interact with it in 360 degrees. Kind of educational. I think the Oogpeaster Beetle is more of a consumer, computer animated, more educational thing. And then
let me tell you about the Oogpeaster Beetle, Nate. It can fire a jet of some sort of liquid from its back end that gets superheated to quite a large degree, so that would be quite interesting to see in in full VR 360 and slow motion.
I don't really want to be behind it, to be honest. That sounds terrifying. Well, Bear Island may be more terrifying. It follows black bears, they're much larger than beetles, on a journey to an Alaskan river. Viewers are going to be able to jump between different perspectives of the bear, different storylines about their journeys, with virtual reality helping to make it feel like they're right there next to Mr. Grizzly. BBC says the episodes will be available before the end of January, which is very exciting, and will be free to download for the first 3 months. Now, I've always thought that the best things to see in virtual reality have got to be documented. Documentaries. Mm-hmm. Films, that's one thing, but you know, a director's always going to present what they think is the best thing to be looking at any given moment. Video games is an obvious one, but we've already kind of got that. Documentary filmmaking, though, it's the sort of thing where you want Attenborough to be in front of you and talking to you, but you always want to be able to move around and just look at, you know, just what's left of the camera, what's below you, what are you standing on, what's the camera positioned on. And I think that Planet Earth and BBC Earth, getting into this is just extremely exciting. I can't wait for this. I don't have a Samsung Gear VR, but I'm going to have to borrow one in order to try this out.
Yeah, this is the time when you need to get something really good to watch this on, because I can just imagine being in, say, the middle of a bison migration, and there's the camera right in the middle, so you can look around and you can see the different animals charging from all over the place or wandering through a forest. This is essentially Attenborough taking you by the hand and leading you through the most beautiful parts of the world. And these are places that are you want to see in full 360. It's not, you know, we've talked about movies maybe, but really there's always one point that you need to focus on, whereas that isn't the case with these documentaries. You want to look all the way around, and sure, you might only need to look at one part where the animal's there, but you want to take in the whole atmosphere, the whole place, and this is really what VR is for.
Well, it's going to be out for you before the end of this month, so we'll maybe check back on this and see what it's like. Well, moving into another kind of end of year report, essentially. This one from the UK's Entertainment Retailers Association, which, as everyone will know, is the source of the most exciting annual reports. This year, of course, no exception. Sorry, there was a bit of sarcasm there. Just wanted to make sure that came across.
Mildly came across in the tone.
Good. But it is very interesting stuff, and that's with no sarcasm at all. It has said that for the first time in 2016, the video market became a majority digital business in the UK, with revenues from downloads and subscription services, such as iTunes, Sky's on-demand stuff, Amazon, Netflix, etc., are now, for the very first time ever in the UK, exceeding those of DVD and Blu-ray. Specifically, digital video revenues in the UK were as high as £1.3 billion in 2016, which is 20% up over 2015, except that physical revenues from DVD and Blu-ray were down just under 20% as well, to just a hair under £900 million. In music, revenues had grown 4.6% in 2016, and this was apparently powered by a 65% rise in music subscription revenues in Britain. Digital services now for music account for about 57% of all music revenues in the UK. So again, all that is based on streaming services alone. And it meant that overall, the sales of music, video and games are £1 billion ahead of where they were in 2012. So streaming, if we want to draw a conclusion here, really has now, as of 2016, become the mainstream, overtaking physical across all three major entertainment platforms, or types, rather. This makes me very excited across my entire body, because the demand existing there really does, I think, open the door for a much wider range of services coming to cater for the areas that maybe are currently just leaving something to be desired, such as, I wanted to pick one example, high-end audio streaming. I don't know if you saw, Andy, this week, Tidal is switching on support for studio master quality audio. Normally,
that's higher than it was already doing.
Yeah, I mean, CD quality currently eclipses anything you stream from, say, Spotify or Apple or Amazon, but Tidal's eclipses CDs significantly. They've only got about 30,000 tracks compared to about 30 million on Spotify and friends. But it's a start. They've been doing hi-fi, you know, high-end streaming for a while, but this is now even higher still. This is more in the region of Super Audio CD, which is much, much higher still, and but difficult to make digital at the moment, and as accessible as streaming services are. But either way, this is all great news for audiophiles, for streaming video lovers. I've not seen anything hugely negative in here, although I know you have, Pans, something you wanted to mention about the Grand Tour.
Well, yeah, because on the one hand, these figures that you've been throwing out, that shows the faith that we've always had that people want to pay for video and for music, so they want to use legal services rather than just getting things illegally. However, in December, some analyst reports said that the Grand Tour, that's Clarkson, Hammond and May's, you know, the new Top Gear, essentially the Amazon version, the Grand Tour show may well have been the most pirated TV show in the history of TV.
Wow, really? More than Game of Thrones?
Apparently the first episode was illegally downloaded 7.9 million times, with the subsequent two episodes being downloaded 6.4 and 4.6 million times, respectively. Which, obviously, those are huge, huge numbers, even though this is a show that is available on Amazon Prime. I think it just really shows that people aren't willing to stump up more money for extra services like Amazon's Prime if they're already paying money for Netflix, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, the Amazon one's an interesting example, because it's not just a case of signing up for a streaming video service or buying, you know, eight episodes to download. You're having to buy an e-commerce package for a year to access, which is quite an ask if you just want to watch the new Top Gear. It's nowhere near as simple, even if the price was competitive, which I think what you get for Amazon Prime, it's a good price. But if all you want is to watch the new Clarkson show, then paying whatever it is, about £100 a year, is a hell of an ask. But let us know if you have any thoughts on those figures being basically pretty good for the UK in the streaming media world. There was one other thing completely the opposite end of the chart, which is vinyl sales apparently have reached a 25-year high. And I feel like for the last 5 years, every year on a podcast I've done, I've had a story at some point about how vinyl is breaking a new record. But it did last month.
Record, I get it.
Very good, very good. Last year, it topped 3 million sales for vinyl in the UK. It was the highest since 1991, when apparently Simply Red's album Stars was the biggest record.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a 50% rise year over year, so it's not even just a small incremental figure. It's literally twice as half as many again as they sold last year, but it's still accounting for just under 3% of the overall music market. Obviously, CD sales we've seen are falling massively year over year. 47.3 million CDs were bought in 2016, which just feels like such a tiny little number. That's a drop of 12%.
Nay, are you suggesting that in 2017, the music industry's big growth segment is vinyl?
No, I'm saying in 2016 it was.
But that presents an opportunity in 2017.
Yes, next year, it would not surprise me if that was even higher still. I imagine next year at this time, you can mark it on your calendars, check back with the show in a year's time, I'll be saying it's the biggest bump in quarter of a century plus 1 year. Because there's no lessening demand or momentum for vinyl, apparently, at the moment. Either way, it's a good place to be. People making more money from music, and that's no bad thing to see taking place.
I think this is not too surprising, because what I see from a lot of bands, including, for example, I'm right next to one of yours by Cradle of Filth, is that there are a lot of bands putting out these special edition printed vinyls, which are designed for wall mounting. They're designed for display and for keeping. They're not just a way of playing the music. You don't buy them and then put them on at a party. It's just about owning this special object in an era where you're not buying CDs anymore.
It's interesting because I own a total of 3 special edition vinyls, but own a total of 0 turntables. Well, we're going to just return very briefly to a little more from CES. One of the things I asked Ian to check out was LG's ridiculously thin 77-inch television, which measures 2.6 millimeters deep. I saw that compared to 4 credit cards pressed together. That's how thick it is.
Does it have to be 4 credit cards? Because I don't have 4 credit cards, but I could do credit card, Oyster card, library card, and some sort of coffee loyalty card. Is that enough?
I'd say it's about comparable.
That's fine.
About comparable. It hangs on the wall using magnets because it's not thick enough to support screws or indeed support any ports. It has to have a little clip-on bar underneath just to enable the connectivity that it needs in order to display a picture. Anyway, I asked Ian on his very last hour at CES to push through his dehydration, just get as much energy as he possibly could into one last report for us about LG's television, and he sent this in.
Okay, so I've come to the LG stand to look at their new ultra-thin TV. You know, you'll have to take my word for it, because obviously this is audio, not video. And it is very thin indeed. I saw one tweet that described it as thin as wallpaper, which it most certainly is not. It is very impressive, though, and it is extremely thin. I think it would only really work if you were going to wall mount it, because otherwise it's just going to sort of flap around in the middle of your living room. And that would be a bit of a disaster. So very much designed for wall mounting. Looks incredible. Colours are amazing. Beautiful blacks. But you have this media bar at the bottom that's sort of a requirement of it that allows you to plug in devices, obviously, because the TV isn't thick enough to have any actual sockets on it. But the upside to this media bar thing is that it has Dolby Atmos built in, so you should get some pretty amazing surround sound. So from that perspective, it's pretty impressive, actually. And it certainly looks the part. I think it's going to go on sale for roughly £92 million or something. I have no idea, honestly. But it's won a whole stack of awards. Tech Radar have given it Best TV. And then everything else as well. It's pretty good, I've got to say. And it's certainly drawing a big crowd. People do love a thin TV. And we've been seeing them in this manner for many, many years. And this one is the thinnest. But it doesn't do anything particularly new, apart from being an OLED, and it's very expensive. And it's 77 inches. And that's pretty much all I've got to say about it.
He doesn't sound too happy, does he?
He's tired, bless him. He's done a lot out there this week. But it was good to get a hands-on report, at least. And it does sound like he's generally in favour of the television and seems to agree with the awards that it's won being justified. But I'm extremely excited to see that TV in picture, because I've never seen a TV that thin in person. I imagine his estimation of the cost is just slightly hyperbolic. I think it might be just a little exaggerated. Probably more like £2,000 or £3,000 when it actually hits shelves, but we'll see. One last thing I wanted to touch upon from CES was just around Amazon Alexa. And we saw an LG fridge powered by Alexa. We've also heard of cars being powered by the voice assistant Alexa. Now, this is the Alexa that is in the Amazon Echo, the big, big push that Amazon's made into home automation and assistance and shopping, of course. But we have seen it at CES in everything. We've seen it in refrigerators. We've seen it into little smart home robots. We've seen it in lamps from General Electric. We've seen it in dancing robots. We've seen it in alarm clocks, more cars. Volkswagen put it in cars. We've seen it in smartwatches. We've seen it in smartphones from Huawei. We've seen it inside tiny little cameras. I mean, we've just seen it in almost every product category that was at CES. I'm sure it's in something to do with toilets, something to do with hair dryers. We just didn't look quite hard enough. And Andy, when I asked you what was the big trend from CES this year, your answer to me was Alexa's in everything, isn't it?
Yeah, Alexa's all over the place. And I'm really glad because voice assistance is clearly like that's the big trend at the moment. Everything's voice activated and will answer to you and talk to you. But what I'm glad is that these individual companies are using the existing Alexa software. They're using what Amazon's already doing. They're not trying. It's not that everyone has their own version of an assistant that they're all trying to roll out. I mean, there are other ones. You know, Google Assistant is new, and that will be in more things. But right, we could easily be talking about 20 different products, each of which has their own version of an assistant, none of which would work very well. But instead, they've been sensible and have actually gone with one that's existing that they know to work. I think that is great.
Yeah, I agree. I like Alexa. I think it's a great idea. I think that we're heading into an interesting era of marketing for these different assistants. Obviously, Microsoft has Cortana. We've seen cars at CES powered by Cortana. We've got Google's Assistant, which also we've seen cars powered by that. We've got Apple's Siri, which is baked into some cars in CarPlay, into home automation as well, and obviously into the iPhone and other iOS devices and the Mac. We've got Alexa, and there are others out there, independent AI systems that are cropping up and being baked into other technologies too. So this is probably going to be the thing that we want to look at again in 12 months time and just see how much these have moved on, how many have caught on. But at least right now, it looks like the front runner, at least purely based on what was at CES and what's going to come to market this next year, is Alexa. Alexa has won the gold in, arguably CES, if you want to be really broad, but certainly in terms of its ability to be integrated into the widest range of products.
Does Alexa appeal to you at all, Nate? You have a nice house, and you are exactly the sort of person who could have one of the Amazon Echo speakers with Alexa built in sitting on your sideboard so that you can just bark questions at it whenever you want, but you don't. Why not?
That's a really good question. I don't actually know, because I think broadly it's because I've never felt like there's anything I'm doing that would be enhanced by voice commands. I've had Siri in a phone and never use it. I've had it in a Mac and never use it. I've got Windows 10 on my gaming PC. I never use Cortana for anything voice activated. I've got an Amazon Echo in the house. It's just not plugged in.
And you've got a fiancé.
And I've got a fiancé. She wants to use the Echo, so I might just get her to set that up and maybe she can give me some feedback. But I don't know why. It's just one of these things where I've just not felt compelled to use it for any of these products, not just Amazon's, but just anything. Like I don't know. Maybe this is the impetus I needed. I have no answer to that question that's viable or good. So maybe this is the point. I'm going to set it up. I'm going to try using some of these for the next few months and see what I learn.
Yeah, I've just given you the challenge there. So in 6 months' time, we'll return to this and I'll ask you again, how are you finding it? And you'll say it's pointless or not.
I may have fallen in love with it. I mean, it's happened before, but we'll come back to it. Let's check in with Tom Merritt, DailyTechNewsShow.com, and see what he's learned this week.
Hey, thanks, Nate. This week started out talking about cloud PCs and whether the latency is finally low enough to make them useful for things like gaming or AutoCAD. Then most of the rest of the week was dominated by CES, from thin TVs with speakers in the screen to autonomous cars from everyone to Amazon Voice Services becoming the new leader in the smart home space and showing up in cars as well. We finished the week with a discussion about the U.S. Federal Trade Commission's efforts to encourage Internet of Things device makers to be more secure. All that and more at DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Well, Ian will be back with us next week, and thank you to everybody who, over the last month or so, has been submitting answers to our survey. We have had hundreds of people give us fantastically insightful responses to our survey. Andrew Hoyle, tell people, please, where they can find you on the web and elsewhere.
On the web, you can find me easily on Twitter with @BatteryHQ, or you can just search Andrew Hoyle on CNET. I'm sure you'll find me. Off the web, you can find me where other good things happen.
And indeed in John Lewis yesterday, as I heard one of your podcast listeners found you.
Yes, that was true. But at least it was in John Lewis, where I was looking at candles rather than in, you know, Anne Summers looking at fist-shaped objects.
Always the best way.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.